Krueger here, and you're listening to Mike the Birdman Dodd and the rest of the crew this week in Geek.net.
Did you grow up with a NES, PlayStation, Star Wars, cartoons, and 80s TV? Do you like to think who would win in a fight between Batman and the Master Chief? Comics, games, movies, music, and TV, they're gonna tell you everything you need. Superheroes or not, they got your back, they're gonna save the world of geeks. Comics, games, movies, music, and TV, they're gonna tell you everything you need. Or not, they got your back, they're gonna save the world of geeks. This week in geek, this week in geek.
Hey guys, what's going on? You are listening to This Week in Geek.net's topic show for the month of October, and guys, it feels good to be back here in the studio because it's Halloween time, and there's going to be a lot of really awesome stuff coming up on the site this week. We have a bunch of new DVD commentaries for the original Dracula, the original Frankenstein, and new Warner Brothers release, The Conjuring, which actually is going to be released on Halloween, and that'll be featuring me and David Double D Dennis. And if you guys haven't guessed, I'm Mike the Birdman Dodd, and this show is brought to you by the good folks over at offworlddesigns.com, where you can use promo code BROHOOF to get 10% off orders pretty much everywhere. It also works on international orders as well, so check that out. Audible.com, GameAccess.ca, NobleKnight.com, OneUpYourLife.com, SFI.org, Starfleet, the world's largest Star Trek online fan club, and finally, BigAndTallMart.com, using promo code GEEK10, get you 10% off orders, $50 or more. But I'm not alone as I trek through the Universal Movie Monster Catalog. I'm joined with my able-bodied youthful ward,
the Children of the Night, Scott Bortis.
And you will get used to these. And of course, it's not Halloween here on This Week in Geek without my friend. I've been friends with James, I guess I just spoiled the surprise, for the last 7 years, actually.
Oh, wow.
My God, how the hell have I known you this long?
It's considered a common law now.
I can't even think back to the first time. Where was it?
I think we just randomly, you had just started doing your angry Nintendo nerd videos. I sent you a message on YouTube. It just kept going back and forth. Then we started talking on my show. And then we would meet each other at MAGFest or some convention for at least 20 minutes, half hour.
It might have been one of the Screw Attack conventions first, like the Iron Man one.
Yeah, back in 2008, the first time I met you face to face. My God, such a long time ago. So, as always, James, it is a pleasure to have you here on the show.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thanks for asking me again.
So, guys, like I said, we're going to be talking Universal Movie Monsters, something I know James knows like the back of his hand. This traces all the way back to 2007's, the original Monster Madness, when that came out, sort of going through the history of horror, and then was continued on in Sequel-thon, and then with more detail through other Monster Madnesses. Obviously, you can find these all up on YouTube or on Cinemassacre.com if you want to find out more information. So, guys, we're not going to waste your time anymore. We're going to hit you with a little bit of a factoid thing we like to call Just the Facts.
I am Dracula. I bid you welcome. Listen to them, children of the night. What music they make.
Welcome back, my horror movie fiends, for This Week in Geek.net's topic show for the month of October, and this time we're looking at the classic Universal horror movie monsters and their legacies. Universal Monsters applies to a series of horror and suspense movies made by Universal Studios from about 1923 to just about 1960. The series began with the 1923 version of The Hunchback of Notre Dame and continued with such movies such as Phantom of the Opera, Dracula, Frankenstein, The Mummy, The Invisible Man, Bride of Frankenstein, The Wolfman, Wolfman, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, Son of Dracula, Creature from the Black Lagoon, and among many others which are entirely too many to list and you'd be here all damn day. The studio's leading horror actors were Lon Chaney, Bela Lugosi, Boris Karloff, and Lon Chaney Jr., and the numerous directors would include Todd Browning and James Whale. The era would begin soundless and start with The Hunchback of Notre Dame with Lon Chaney back in 1923, but it was more of a historical drama more so than anything else. The next feature would feature Chaney again, but this time as the legendary Phantom of the Opera. Things began to change as the decade drew to a close, and we would unfortunately see the death of Lon Chaney due to throat cancer, but we would see the birth of something else. Sound in horror movies, and the era began with the unsettling gothic horror of Dracula with Bela Lugosi. Dracula would make his theatrical debut and scare audiences in 1931 with Lugosi in the lead role, along with Renfield, played by Dwight Fry, and Edward Van Sloan as Dr. Van Helsing. This film would introduce many elements that would become a part of the vampire mythos, such as the accent, the cape, the gothic atmosphere, and the crumbling castle. We owe a lot of this to Mr. Lugosi, so thanks for that! Not long after, we would be introduced to the mad science of Dr. Henry Frankenstein, with Colin Clive in the role, and the monster would be played by the man himself, Boris Karloff. The monster would also have a few sequels with him in the role. Heavy makeup and the performance given would shock theatergoers at this time. It is one of the only movies I can think of that actually has a warning before it delivered completely straight. We would also get a direct sequel with The Bride of Frankenstein. Universal would churn out more hits like The Animal Trapped Inside the Man with Lon Chaney Jr.'s The Wolfman, and we'd get chills again from The Mummy with Boris Karloff, and even later still with The Creature from the Black Lagoon in the mid-1950s. There would also even be a Battle Royale smackdown with The House of Frankenstein. Films that were also released in this golden era include Man-Made Monster, Invisible Agent, Weird Woman, The Mad Ghoul, Son of Dracula, She-Wolf of London, and even the comedy of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, among many, many others. The classic era would end around the 1960s, but the legacy lives on through multiple releases and theaters playing homage to these horrors of the silver screen. We may not always still fear Frankenstein's monsters, Dracula, the Wolfman, the Hunchback, or even the Mad Scientist, but we respect where they came from and where they will lead the horror genre going forward. Today we celebrate these titans of terror with Cinemassacre's James Rolfe on ThisWeekInGeek.net's topic show for the month of October.
It's alive! Oh, in the name of God! Now I know what it feels like to be God!
Welcome back, my children. As you just heard, the just the facts for the Universal Monster movies. And, man, these movies are classics. They are such fun movies to watch, especially at this time of year.
You know, I didn't used to like the idea of Universal horror movies. And I'll tell you why. I always had this conception that they were stupid, they were cheesy, because they were black and white, they sucked. Allow me to say that I was an ignorant fuck.
Then you went to college.
Yeah, and then I went to college and I completely recant this. In fact, what we're going to talk about now is how we first discovered these. And I'll go first just to paint you how much of an ignorant fuck I actually am. It turns out a year ago today is the first time that I saw this. So thank you, Get Glue, for tracking when I watch movies. I went to my local theater. They had this double bill, which was really cool. For $6, you could go see the original Dracula and the original Frankenstein. Now, my wife didn't want to go with me. She doesn't like horror movies or black and white movies in general, and that's whatever. So I go, and literally, it's like something out of Frankenstein. Literally, it's like there's all this fog everywhere. It's a dark night. I'm driving by myself. There's wind whipping around. There's leaves everywhere. Like, it literally seems like a scene out of a horror movie. So I pull up to the theater, and there's me and maybe 7 or 8 other people in there. So not a super successful double bill, but it's people I know that give a shit about this. So I go in there. I do not know what to expect. And I'm sitting in the theater, and Dracula comes up on screen. Now, this is the first time I'd ever seen Bela Lugosi that wasn't, you know, Martin Landau, and I was utterly impressed. Like, I did not expect these movies to A, clip along so fast because horror movies back then didn't have to follow, oh, you must be 90 minutes, blah, blah, blah. And I was utterly blown away. Like, I could not believe how entertaining these were. And I could see, wow, I could see how other horror movies had taken inspiration from this. And literally, there was a 15-minute break in between Dracula and Frankenstein. So I called up my wife on my cell phone. And I'm like, holy shit, you really should have come. This is actually really good. There's no way you can get bored in these movies because they were all succinct and so fast. And then Frankenstein came on the screen later, and I'm sitting there just utterly entranced by, I think it's Colin Clive, the guy that plays Dr. Henry Frankenstein in, obviously, Frankenstein. And this guy's presence on screen completely sucked me in. And it's that, and it was that moment where he starts talking to Dr. Waldman, Edward Van Sloan. And he says, wouldn't you want to know why the sky is blue, what's beyond the stars, etc. like that? And I'm thinking, holy shit, I need to see all of these. And that's how I got into it. So I feel so dumb for loving horror movies like Chucky, Jason, Freddy for all these years and never giving these guys a shake.
Oh, so that was just last year, huh?
Yeah, just last year. And I've really started to look back at other directors like in the horror genre. I want to go back and see more of James Whale stuff, Todd Browning stuff, and just see where these guys have come from in movies that they did that weren't horror, because I love their style. So, Scotty, what about you? How did you first discover the Universal movie monsters?
Well, the time I first discovered the Universal movie monsters was in a Burger King's kids meal.
What?
It was like the 90s, and they had like the Creature from the Black Lagoon, the Wolfman, like toys in your little Happy Meals there. And that was the first time, I was like 4 or 5, somewhere around there. And that was the first time I had actually like seen these guys. And I'd always had a love. I always loved the way they looked. But it wasn't till later that I actually got to see any of the films. Around that still time period, my family, I guess, because Bela Lugosi was Hungarian, and that's my background. My uncle and my grandfather like had a big love for the guy because he was a fellow countryman. So my uncle would always tell me elaborate stories how we are actually descendants of the bloodline of vampire hunters and stuff like this. All these weird stories when I was a kid, which always really got me interested to see these films. And I saw Dracula when I was little. Bits and pieces of it. I don't remember when exactly it all happened, but I just remember seeing a bit of it at my grandparents' house. I think my uncle had brought it over, and I was a scaredy cat of any kind of monster or horror films. And I was like, oh, if it's on a TV screen, it's probably going to scare me. I don't know what's going to happen here. He's going to jump out, scare me, kill somebody. So I never actually watched the whole thing. Then a few years later, I had gotten The Mummy from the library because I had seen the remakes, and I was like, oh, these are cool. I want to see the original one. And then I watched that with my grandpa as well, and I really liked it. It was something about it, like, feeling like I knew the story already, which was really cool to see, and then see the films from the 1930s. And just comparing both of them as a kid, I thought that was kind of cool, knowing that a film from 1932 was still captivating an audience in the new millennium. But then I hadn't seen any of the horror films until recently, when I actually went out to see them on, I wanted to get the Blu-ray set, and I just wanted to watch all of them to see what I was missing. And that comes to around now when I finally got to see the rest, well, most of the Universal films.
And then finally, James, because I know you had a huge love of these for probably most of your life. How did you first get into these guys?
Yeah, I was about 11 or 12 when I first got into the Universal monster movies. And there was no internet back then, so they weren't that easy to find. You'd think these movies would be on TV all the time, but they weren't, or at least I could never find them. They used to show them back in the 50s as part of those shock packages, but our generation wasn't really being exposed to them. However, we were being exposed to them in just different ways, like on cereal boxes and, you know, cartoons and stuff. Like, the monsters were everywhere. Like, you almost knew them even if you didn't see any of the movies. And I think the books that really got me into them were the these books by Ian Thorne, the Crestwood House series, and I did a video on that, which explains it more. You'll find that I keep doing that all the time. Like I'll keep saying I have a video, because then if that just means if there's a longer answer, basically. Those books were what got me interested in them. And those are old books, too. They're from, like, the 70s. But they just happened to be laying around in my school's library, and I found them and I read them. But then it was all just screenshots, all just stills. So I would have to imagine what the movie looked like if it was moving. So those books were really good for my imagination. And then it was interesting to see the actual movies and then find, you know, how close my imagination was to it. And I didn't really start finding them until some of my video stores would have them. And then I found out you could order them too. So then I just started saving up money to buy them. And it was a long process, but I eventually got to see all the ones I wanted to.
So when you started, like, kind of collecting all these tapes, is there one that was maybe particularly hard to find?
They released all the main ones first. Because this was all happening around the same time. Like, they were putting out all these new VHS releases of them, and they sort of did, like, one batch at a time. So first they would do Dracula, Frankenstein, and the Mummy, the Invisible Man, the Wolfman, you know, all the main ones. And then they started getting into more of, like, the Black Cat, the Raven, and all the sequels to the monster movies. But then there were some at the very bottom of the barrel that just never came out on VHS. And I haven't seen those until recently, because they're really rare and hard to track down. But now that I've been watching those, I know why, because they suck. So there's like one called That's the Spirit. Just all these movies you would never hear about, because there's just nothing to remember about them.
Oh. And, you know, that's the thing. I mean, not everything in the Universal movie catalog is necessarily super memorable or good, which is kind of sad. But all the classic ones, pretty much everybody knows and loves. In fact, I didn't even, when I was doing some research for the show last night, and this will kind of transition into what we're going to talk about now, the actual monsters themselves, I didn't realize that for some reason I'd held this thought that Lon Chaney was still the Wolfman. I didn't realize it was Lon Chaney Jr. for a really, really long-ass time.
You think that it was the same actor?
Yeah, I really thought it was that, and then I found that out last night. I'm like, oh, that's terrible. He died of throat cancer before he could ever get cast in Dracula, although they know that they actually wanted him. So let's talk about some of the monsters themselves. And I was just mentioning the Hunchback there and the Phantom of the Opera. Lon Chaney Jr.
Yeah.
Those are two guys I really wish I'd seen more of. In fact, once we're done this show, probably going to go watch that, actually.
Which one?
Probably Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah, the Lon Chaney Sr. one. That's the best one, but both Hunchback and Phantom are in the public domain. And I don't know what it is, but Universal just doesn't want to touch the public domain ones, because I guess they just feel it's not worth their time or whatever. So the version of Phantom that always ends up on those collections, like that Blu-ray, that Essential collection that we were talking about earlier before the, you know, the recording started. Mm-hmm. But like, they always use the 1943 Phantom, which is the color one starring Claude Rains, and it doesn't even come close to the original. It's just really sad that that's the one that they always. It's not a terrible movie, but, and it's actually a lot more, the production is huge. It's in color, and it's, you know, got huge sets and costumes, everything, but it's not anything close to the Lon Chaney one.
Which, that kind of says something, because the fact that Phantom was the original Lon Chaney one had no sound.
Yeah.
Like, it was a purely physical performance. And I think
there was a sound version of it where they dubbed it, but, you know.
It's just not, you know. it kind of takes away from it. And that's something that I liked about the Phantom character, because I've seen all the stills of it, and there's something that very much disturbs the shit out of me. There's something about that very gaunt face, of Lon Chaney that's just it creeps me the fuck out, actually, for lack of a better phrase.
He was great with makeup, because he did all that makeup himself.
And that's, I think, a bit of a lost art these days. Actors that are willing to do that to themselves in some ways. Like, because back then, I think actors were more hardcore in a lot of ways. Because I was reading about Boris Karloff doing Frankenstein and how you have to sit there for like 5 or 6 hours in the makeup chair, do all his own stunts and everything.
And he would go home in that sometimes too.
Oh my God.
That's awesome.
And it seems today like we have stunt doubles, we have all these prosthetics. Back then, I don't know, it was more elbow grease, and I can really appreciate that more.
Well, I also think it comes to the fact that a lot of those actors at the time came from a theater background too.
Yeah, and it really helps their performances. And one performance I'd love to point out, because he was a theater actor, was Bela Lugosi. In Dracula, he has this incredible on-screen presence. Everybody else, except for maybe Dwight Fry and Edward Van Sloan, pale to him. Because whenever he walks in the room, he doesn't have to say anything.
Yeah. It's a face.
You feel this intimidating yet sexy presence. And we do this DVD commentary, which will be out next week, and we talk about it. Like, he's unconventionally handsome in a way that unnerves a man, yet a woman is kind of drawn into it, I think. And it's because of the physicality I think he had by being a theater actor. He knows how to overact at just the right moment to really convey the physical part of the role. And when he speaks, you want to listen. Like, every word he says is important to what will happen to you next.
Yeah.
And that's something I can't think of any actors today, and that's probably ignorant to say, but I really can't, at least off the top of my head, who have that kind of presence.
Kristen Stewart.
Yeah, clearly. You know what? I can't even remember the asshole who played Edward Cullen now. I can't even remember
it. Robert Pattinson. Let's get it real here, Michael Dodd.
Oh, yeah. actually, you know, I'm kind of glad and sad at the same time that you mentioned that, because Dracula from these movies is what we think of as the modern vampire. Like, in Bram Stoker's Dracula, he's this decrepit old guy who does get younger as he drinks more blood. But in Dracula the movie, he has these certain certain physical qualities, the way he dresses, the way he gives this air of high society.
Nobility, almost.
Yeah, like this nobility and yet slight arrogance. Like, I'm better than you. I don't have to tell you that.
I'm Count Dracula. Who are you?
Exactly. Like, he just walks into room and you know it. And that's just what we associate with vampires. And it wasn't until probably, I'd say probably the 80s is when things started to change for vampires. We got the more vicious ones. And then in the 90s, we got the blade vampires. And then in the 2000s...
our sexy vampires.
And it's sexy because it's literally the actor is sexy. Whereas I think someone like Bela Lugosi brought sexy because it was a confidence that didn't need to be conveyed by a fucking ab machine.
Don't worry, I would have slept with Bela Lugosi if he looked at me like that. If he started waving his hand, I would have been like, yes, sir.
Well, the thing about Bela Lugosi is he has these intense eyes.
He very much so. When he's looking, you can see the concentration, and like, he's not breaking any eye contact.
And it's weird because as I did more research for this, I was listening to a documentary about him. He would only memorize the lines for the movie he was doing in English, so it wasn't his first language. So he'd have these odd pauses and these odd mannerisms to it. And when he performed the role, he threw himself 150% into it. And when he stared at you, like, there's that great close-up in Dracula where the camera kind of starts to push in on his eyes and they're all kind of lit up. And then there's another one where he's going after Mina and he's just about to bite her, and the camera pauses on his face again. And just that intensity right there.
Yeah, and there's so much silence in the movie, too, because they were just off of the silent era, and they didn't really think to put in music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is a music track somebody did in recent years, but it doesn't, for some reason, it doesn't work. That movie just doesn't need music.
It plays off the tension of it being silent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's, while going back and watching Dracula, as you both mentioned, it didn't have a soundtrack. I mean, there are pieces of music that are played at the beginning and in the opera scene.
Yeah.
And that's about it. The fact that it doesn't have sound, it's an unintentionally tension-building element that, like Scott mm-hmm. had just mentioned. And there are certain scenes where it is so effective that I wonder if the director didn't even know it. And
it's really cool too that you said that your first time seeing it, you really got into it too, right?
Yeah, like literally, it sucked me in.
That's cool, yeah. Because a lot of people have trouble with Dracula, especially because it's very quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Even as a kid, that was one where I had to see it a few times for it to really grow on me the way it did. But yeah, it's like all that sort of all that just plays to its advantage.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so. And again, it's also the unintentional in the sense that it was only 4 years into the era of talkies. So it's like they didn't really have all the pre-established, like, let's put soundtrack in here while we're talking and stuff. And
yeah.
Sorry?
Oh, I was about to say, yeah. And even as the horror movies progressed throughout the years, they knew enough when to play with sound, because sound design was still very new in its infancy with this. So
yes.
It's, I don't know. Like I said, this is one of those movies that will obviously be preserved for all time.
Yeah.
And it's something I wish my film professor had shown me when I went to college mm-hmm. a number of years ago, because I would have appreciated sound design more because it was absent in Dracula.
And yeah, you can pick it up easier, I think, because there's not much of it, so you'd be able to notice where these things are happening.
Yeah, but then you go to Frankenstein, which came right after, and The Old Dark House, which came right after that, and those movies had storms going on,
mm-hmm.
so the reason there is sound is because there's constant thunder and rain and wind, so...
And it changes up the film completely.
Yeah.
Which... All right, let's actually talk about Frankenstein, and we're kind of doing this out of order, which is fine for me. Looking at Frankenstein, as you mentioned, James, it had a really great sound for it, and it's something that really helps get you into it, because one of the old tropes I've heard about making horror movies is half your movie is sound. Horror movies are goofy if you take away the sound, the lone exception being Dracula.
Yeah.
To it. And there's little things in that movie that really, 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 really get you into the scene. The one that does it most for me is when he brings the monster to life and you hear that crackling of electricity and just electricity. That was a sound they must have captured on set, because electricity, when you hear it in movies now, doesn't have that raw crackle.
Uh-huh.
Where it has that really rough edge to it. It sounds more polished today. It sounds more like a Brent Burt sound effect from Star Wars.
Yeah. You really believe that it's antique equipment that's just buzzing all over the place.
And which is really cool, because I think they kept that stuff around till the 1970s, that original Frankenstein gear. Then I guess I don't know what happened to it.
I heard they used it on Young Frankenstein. It was the same gear.
Which is incredible, the fact that it stayed around for that long. Because I know not all sets necessarily get kept.
Yeah, I think some of it still exists, actually. I'm really not sure, but...
Well, especially if it existed until Young Frankenstein, then I'm assuming people would have tried to buy that stuff up.
Yeah. In fact, somebody just sent me a picture. One of my friends was at Universal Florida. And said he sent me a picture that they had in like a glass case. They had some of the light bulb sort of things that went off, and it looked pretty ancient. But I'm not sure if it's, because you know you never know that some things are replicas, and you know
is very hard to authenticate unless you were actually there, so to speak.
Yeah, because the only things that I've heard that have survived from any of those movies were, let's see, the boots from the monster in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. I think that's in Bob Burns' collection. The Dracula cape Lugosi was buried in, that was the one from Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. I think the original cape Forry Ackerman had, but after he passed away, I'm not sure who bought up all his stuff.
I know his son still has one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there was a part in the documentary about Bella where they mention he was buried in one of the capes. He had 8 capes to begin with, but he sold them off over the years, and he still has one, which he's going to keep. So I'd like to know where these all ended up. And I know there aren't many movie posters left from this era either. I used to watch this show. I think it was called Hollywood Treasures.
Yeah, that's a great show.
Yeah, you see some really neat shit on there.
Oh, I know.
And they found an original Frankenstein poster, and I think it went for something like 10 grand.
Oh my gosh. Those are so beautiful, though.
And there's the original mummy poster that Kirk Hammett from Metallica bought, and it was because he put out a horror book that's all his collection, and it's crazy. The mummy one, I can't remember the number offhand, but he just went to this guy's house, dropped down, I'm going to say like tens of thousands of dollars in cash on the guy's table, and he still didn't want to give it to him. He eventually got it, but it was like the only mummy poster in existence.
Oh my gosh.
Holy shit.
That's awesome.
That's really...
The art behind these things are beautiful, though.
Oh my god, yeah. In that Blu-ray set from Universal, you get these poster postcards, and they're all replicas of the original movie posters. In fact, I was actually saying this to my friend Dave. Looking at the poster for Frankenstein, that is genuinely, I think, one of the best-looking posters that I've ever seen for a film. And because it literally seems like it's popping out at you, and it just has this style that captures the makeup, it captures the contours of Karloff's face, and it has this really neat color gradient to it that, well, they didn't have Photoshop back then. So there was a real artistry behind these things, as opposed to the movie posters of today, which are just two big heads Photoshop with some stupid text over it. X-Men Days of Future Past, I'm looking at you. and it's just, there's such a beauty to all these. And even seeing the mummy, him and his makeup all wrapped up, Dracula. There's actually something called the Dracula Archives on the Blu-ray, and it's set to music, the music that was played in the beginning. It's like the full suite.
Swan Lake,
and it's just Dracula posters. And it's really neat to see some of the different...
Yeah, there were a lot of posters for those movies. Because even when you brought up the Frankenstein one, I was going through my head thinking of which, you know, because there's like so many different ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I think I know the one you mean, though.
There is one that I like, and it's so... It must have been an Italian release, and it's one where it's Dracula hovering over Mina, and I wish I could remember the actress's name. Something Chambers, wasn't it? It'll probably come to me. Someone's probably yelling at their mic right now. And
those posters I have are 20 years old, and they're still on my wall. I bought them when I was 13.
Oh, my God. I tend to trash my posters, and I've had some really nice ones over the years. I had an original RoboCop.
They're so cool. Like, I just couldn't, you know...
Bear to rip them.
They're not originals or anything like that, you know, but they're just... Look, it's like if you watch the nerd video for Frankenstein, those two posters in the back, those are the ones, I mean...
Actually, where was I going with this? Oh, right. So the poster that I'm talking about is one where Dracula's hovering over Mina, and there's just like a little bubble off to the side. And that's something that I did notice about those movies. They would always have bubbles of scenes that weren't necessarily related to the main picture that was being shown. Like, they've got Dracula posters that show Jonathan talking to Edward Van Sloan, his character mm-hmm. of Dr. Van Helsing. They've got ones that are just people talking, and yet it says Dracula coming out, blah, 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 blah. And that's something really weird. Like, you could get away with that back then, and it was okay.
Now everyone's going to sue you. That's not in the movie.
Well, it's so strange with that. Like, movie posters back then, it was way different than it is now. In fact, there is one movie poster that I want to pick up. It's not a Universal movie, but I just want to talk about this for just 10 seconds. I saw it on AMC's Fear Fest. It was called The Beast Must Die. And it is the weirdest. It's about this guy, this black karate master guy, who goes around the world, gets 10 people to come to his house, and says, one of you is a werewolf, and I'm going to kill you. And it's this, and the cool thing is, it's an interactive movie. Right before the movie starts, this announcer comes on and says, one of these people is a werewolf. Can you guess who? We'll stop at the end of the movie to take your guesses. And it's really, really, really neat. And it also has this weird, funky synth soundtrack to it, too. It's really weird. I think it came out, like, 1974. James, if you get a chance, you should check this out for next year's Monster Madness, because it's so weird but so awesome.
Okay. Peter Cushing's in it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's strange.
It's interactive? Like it was interactive back then?
Yeah, like they stopped the movie at the beginning, and they stop it right at the end.
Is it kind of like William Castle style, like the Tingler and stuff, where they stop the movie and...
Yeah. They, like, kind of stop it, and then it kind of plays out like Clue, where they drop hints about it throughout the movie.
That's
and
awesome.
There's a couple of red herrings along the way. The ending is really neat, that I'll say, but it's the weird performances in it that I really enjoy, and I actually started looking for a poster for it, because I'm thinking... I guess I just became a horror hipster. Like, I like this movie. You've never heard of it. but back to the show at hand. So when we look at some of the other movies that come out of the Universal era, another one that I wish I'd gotten into and very much differed from some of the other films was The Wolfman. And The Wolfman took... It made a man into a monster because it wasn't necessarily the fact that he wanted to be this. It just, that's the way it was. And it brought a different type of humanity to it because you look at Dracula, he is an evil dude. There is no questioning that.
Yeah.
Frankenstein is literally, he is without fault because he is like a child, at least mm-hmm. at least in the first Frankenstein. When you get to the other ones, there's more deliberate action. And with the Wolfman, he has this animal inside of him,
and he can't control.
Yeah, and I think that's something that audiences really got back then, because that's another thing too. Watching these horror movies, there is a lot of commentary there that may not necessarily be intended, but I think really is. I mean, for example, and then we'll talk about the Wolfman. In Frankenstein, they stop the movie at the beginning, and this guy comes out and tells you, this is a movie that explains life and death. If you have a weak heart, well, we warned you. Because you would see the digging of the graves. You'd hear the dirt hit the coffin, the guy hanging right at the very beginning. And when they bring Frankenstein back to life, we all assume, yeah, it's a dead body being reanimated, correct? So mm-hmm. So put yourself in Frankenstein's shoes, those very large shoes, for just a minute. Imagine, if you will, you are the guy waking up in Frankenstein's body. As far as you know...
The monster's body, right?
Yeah.
You are,
get it right, Mike.
Yeah. So you wake up in the monster's body, you're dead. Imagine if you wake up from that. Imagine the utter... terror that you've come back from something. I mean, even if that wasn't an abnormal brain in that body, mm-hmm. that would drive you insane. The fact that you've now cheated death, that you are back. I mean, and some people might say, yeah, I beat death and give it the finger. But just think about the existential terror of what that means. You either confirm there's life after death or there's not. And that knowledge could literally drive you insane. And that's why I look at Frankenstein as a more sympathetic, childlike creature, especially after he accidentally kills the little girl, because he assumes she will float too, just like those flowers.
especially in Bride of Frankenstein, he really starts to mature and everything, and you really see more sides of the monster.
Yeah, and with the Wolfman, you get this idea that, you know, as a man, he has this, you know, men are expected to behave a certain way, civilized. We are not the creatures that roam the forests.
Well, he's kind of a wolf. He's chasing girls down and stuff.
Yeah, because there's a scene in the beginning when he's peeping on that girl through her bedroom, and then he goes to the shop and he says, "I want those earrings you have on your bedroom desk. Yeah. You know the ones you're just trying on? How do you know this? Oh, I'm psychic. Oh, okay then."
Yeah. I loved it. Even as a kid, I loved that, you know. It was just the right amount of creepy. Like, it could have been overkill if it went too far, but, you know, it's just...
It was charming in some odd way.
Yeah, it's like you like the guy going into the movie, and he becomes the wolf. You really do feel sorry for him.
Mm-hmm.
What happens?
And that's something that I think is neat, the fact that he does turn into this wolf creature and can't really control himself through it. And then, like I said, he is creepy.
Yeah, and he's the only one of the monsters that played the monster in all the sequels. So I think, like, it really became his character. Like, nobody else could play. Like, you know, they've had many people into the, you know, the Frankenstein monster makeup and the mummy and all that, but the Wolfman could only be Lon Chaney Jr.
Wasn't he super happy to be typecast because now he's made his mark, or was that Karloff that had said that? I remember.
I think they all were happy with what happened with them all, but Lon Chaney Jr. was he felt really pressured, though, because they start billing him as Lon Chaney Jr. That wasn't even his real name. It was Creighton. But because they were trying to make him into the next Lon Chaney, mm-hmm. He felt so pressured that he actually was just...
He just, like, kind of cracked under it, so to speak?
He definitely cracked. Like, one time, you know, tried to commit suicide on that Blu-ray thing, and that he blamed it on the Wolfman, which is really sad, but...
Well, that actually kind of brings me up to something that I didn't expect to talk about, but it's rather kind of poignant. Almost everybody from these movies, with the exception of Karloff, I'd say, had a real tragedy to them.
Yeah, he was the one that kind of made out best for himself. I'm not sure why that is, but yeah, you always heard stories that Lugosi, they just didn't give him... They would usually put him as a minor character a lot of times as time went on, and he didn't have as
star power kind of thing.
Yeah, I think he even took a big cut in pay for Dracula because he played him on stage 1,000 times. He wanted to be Dracula, and I think he took a smaller pay than somebody else would. So I've heard all different things like that.
Yeah, there was one story about Lugosi kind of going off that, how he started getting... He was typecast. He loved it, and he hated it at the same time. And it was actually funny. So this kind of contradicts something you said in one of your videos. But then again, maybe you have more resources than me to answer this. Mm-hmm. It was said that Lugosi was offered the role of Frankenstein.
Yeah.
He screen tested for it, and the director hated it.
So yeah.
Then they offered it to him. And for years, Lugosi would say he made Karloff by turning down that role.
Yeah, there's two stories. Yeah, like, I've heard both. That most of my life, the one I was heard was that Lugosi turned it down because with Dracula, he was, you know, he would be able to show his face and his voice, and it was very different than what he wanted. He wanted to, because he came to America wanting to be like the hero character. He wanted to be the star, and then Frankenstein was kind of getting away from what he wanted to do. But I have also heard the story about James Whale just didn't like it, and he wanted to use Karloff.
Yeah. Another guy who makes the Universal movies for me because he played Fritz and he played Renfield is Dwight Frye.
Yeah.
This is a guy, his performance in those movies is unparalleled. Mm-hmm. Although my favorite is probably Renfield, because he's got the crazy eyes.
He does, very much so.
Like, he's almost... Sorry, Scotty, go ahead.
I was gonna say the transition you see from him in the beginning of that film to the mild man. Oh, hello, Mr. Dracula. Count Dracula. Here's your luggage tags. And then once you see they open the door in the boat, and you just see the complete transformation. When I was watching it the first time, I thought it was a different character. I wasn't sure it was the same actor when I first saw the movie.
Uh huh.
Because it's just such a drastic change, and he plays it off so well too.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, actually, if you think about it, he's playing. If it were sticking to the book, the guy in the castle would have been Jonathan Harker. So he actually is playing the Harker part and the Renfield part, but they made it both Renfield for whatever reason, and then they made Jonathan Harker a separate character. But
one of the things that happened to Dwight Frye is it turns out this guy, huge family man, really, 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 pretty much by all accounts, a really nice and upstanding guy, died on a bus of a heart attack in 1943, I think it was, or 41. And and obviously he never lived to see what his legacy would become, for though respected in his day. Another one that would happen was
Clive Owen.
Clive.
Yeah, Colin Clive, that's it. Yeah, not Clive Owen. I always get that confused. He allegedly was this huge drunk on set. Mm. And the scenes where it's over the shoulder, there's somebody holding him up. Which is really terrible, because he's another one of these guys who has this presence. He walks into a room, you listen to him. And I think it was his performance that I think gave me a lot of insight into Frankenstein and what the Frankenstein doctor means to me, is the fact that he wants to do good for the good of mankind, but he flew too close to the sun, so to speak.
And there's this ego too kind of thing.
Yeah, like he's going to change the world, but it will be him. It will
Yeah,
be
he becomes God. It's me. God created man in his image. Frankenstein creates his monster in his image.
And while
that's what he thinks.
And for all intents and purposes, life after death, or reanimating dead flesh, that's a good thing. That can save lives. That means no longer do we have to fear mortality. But yeah, obviously, it drives them nuts. Mm-hmm. And it's really sad to see the actor of Colin Clive decline and eventually die of complications from tuberculosis in his later years. Because I would love to see what this man could have accomplished later on. Because the roles that he played were really, really good. I'm trying to think of other people that had a tragedy with this too. I know Bela Lugosi, as he got more and more typecast, I know at one point he went through 3 agents in 3 years because he just couldn't find work, which is really unfortunate. When he died in the 50s, I'm very glad that he got buried in his cape, one last performance, so to speak, to kind of take kind of with him. Mm-hmm. Although Karloff, he was quoted in the documentary. I found the thing that I was talking about there. He talked to his daughter. He said he was very happy that he was typecast, because that means he made the role his own. He made his niche impact on film. And he was happy for it, which I think is really, really, really kind of cool. The fact, because a lot of actors these days who get typecast aren't necessarily happy with it. I know Mark Hamill wasn't super happy with it for a long time, because they're like, oh, that's fucking Luke Skywalker. And then when he broke out in the voice acting roles, you know, he was no longer Luke. He was the Joker, and he could do these other roles. Some of them questionable, like the Guyver live-action movie. but one that's more awesome that no one knows about is a John Carpenter-proposed television series called Body Bags, where he plays this ex-baseball player who gets his eye stabbed out, and he takes the eye of a killer and tries to kill people. It's really cool. You should check it out. It's from Shout Factory, Scream Factory collection. But getting back to where we started, another, I don't know, where should we go with the next movie monster? Because one I don't have any experience with is The Mummy. I've only seen the remake, and I hope to Christ it doesn't have a lot to do with the Brendan Fraser thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, I just did The Mummy as Monster Madness this year, so you could go to that for my long answer, I guess. What about the mummy?
What makes him scary?
The mummy is kind of like the original zombie, really.
Yeah.
It's just, But I like the idea of the zombie being more decayed. So I've always thought of, if I were to do a mummy movie, it would be just bones under bandages. But the original Mummy takes it a totally different way, which is really good. It's actually a lot like Dracula, but it's like if you just took Dracula but made it, you know, made him a mummy instead. They both come from a, you know, like an exotic place far away, and they have the same kind of love interest going on, and they have that same kind of hypnosis power, and you have the same actors playing the parts too. You have Edward Van Sloan in there, and you know, what else about the Mummy? There's just too much, I guess, to talk about.
Yeah, it's one I really want to see because it's got this wonderful reputation, and it's also one of those movies where if you see a still out of it, you know exactly what movie it is.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, because he's not the stereotypical mummy that's wrapped up in bandages the whole movie, so it almost like whenever you see the Universal monsters all grouped together, it's always the wrapped mummy usually. Like if it were the cereal boxes, if it was Yummy Mummy or, you know, or in a cartoon, it would never be the, you know, Boris.
It wouldn't be Imhotep, it would be the bandages.
Yeah.
There's only one good update to that makeup that I can think of where they kind of keep the bones and the bandages. Fred Dekker's Monster Squad from 87.
Oh, yes. There you go.
Actually, legitimately creepy as shit. And how they kill him is awesome with a bow and arrow and a tree. That's a guy I wish that had continued in Hollywood. Because Monster Squad and Night of the Creeps are amazing.
Yeah.
Although RoboCop 3
is even better than those two combined.
Get off my show.
Okay.
Now, one that I want to talk about again is one that I haven't seen, but I know you two have. Creature from the Black Lagoon. Now, this was from a later on time, right? Like this was 54, in the
50s? I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is actually like Silver Age horror.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like if you were to put, you know, do it like the way comic books are, it's like the Golden Age, I would say, is the 30s and 40s. Anything before that is the Ancient Age before they became such a huge genre. And then the Silver Age is the 50s and 60s, where a lot is going on, where you have the sci-fi alien invader movies and Creature from the Black Lagoon in there. But then you also have Hammer. And you have Alfred Hitchcock and William Castle. And then at the end of all that, you have George Romero. And then that takes it into the Bronze Age where, you know, it goes on and on. But and then, of course, the Modern Age would be later. But, you know, not to get into the whole thing. What was I trying to answer? I don't even remember.
Well, we're talking about the creature from the Black.
Yeah, you're just asking, yeah, when it was from. Yeah, it's from 1954. And that one had two sequels also, which aren't as good, but they're still worth seeing. They get worse as they go on. The Creature Walks Among Us is kind of forgettable, but they did something new with it. They tried to give the creature lungs, and he gets like a lung transplant, and they make him into a, you know, where he can breathe oxygen. It was actually kind of a good idea what they were going for, but.
I'm just trying to process this.
Yeah. I have to say, I rather enjoyed that one. Not the lung one. I haven't seen that. But the Creature from the Black Lagoon. I think of all those films, it is the latest one, isn't it? Considered in the Universal block of like...
Yeah.
That's set, I think it was the latest one.
Yeah, I did a video about that one time where I was trying to figure out what is legitimately the last Universal monster. Yeah. I think I went all the way to Jaws. But yeah, I mean, the creature is the last of the classic Universal monsters that usually ends up in that group.
But I think it also, you can see such a huge difference, especially in the film itself. Can go back to look at Dracula and then look at this film. You see how film has progressed in those 20 years. And I think if anyone is going to really try to jump right into the Universal monster stuff and isn't I guess, isn't too... Shit, I don't know what the word I'm thinking of is, but this one, I guess, is closer to modern cinema, like modern films kind of thing, with soundtrack and stuff like that and the effects. That might be easier for you to jump into it comparatively, say, than jumping right into Dracula.
Yeah, because basically Jaws is a remake of Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Basically.
On a much bigger budget and
yeah.
Dark, but yeah.
And they had a bigger boat, I think.
Yeah.
Now, I'm looking on Wikipedia for some of the things that are considered universal monsters. Some of these I don't know whether I necessarily agree with as we're starting to kind of wind down the hour here. And I guess we're going to talk about how these things have kind of influenced later on films and their kind of legacy. According to Wikipedia, the Universal Monsters legacy, the later years, included the Leech Woman, Psycho.
Well, if you do like the Leech Woman, then there's really a lot more that you like. It's sort of like you have the major league monsters, and then if you go under that, there's
the farm teams.
Like the Captive Jungle Woman, like that's the series. That was like three movies. That was like a series, but it sucks and nobody remembers it. So, and then the Creeper, you know, Rondo Hatton.
One of them that gets mentioned, and I didn't think Universal did this one, so here you get to call me ignorant again, is evidently The Thing is considered a Universal monster.
Wait a minute. The Thing? That was RKO.
Oh, well, no, I'm talking about the 1982 one.
Oh.
Yeah, they consider that.
I was going to ask which one you were talking about.
Here's the thing. If Universal remakes it, like they remade King Kong, would that make King Kong a Universal monster?
According to Wikipedia and their remakes thing, he's not officially considered, but he's often mistaken to be part of that group, but now they just consider him part of the Universal legacy, so to speak.
Yeah, Psycho is it sort of iffy territory because Paramount made that film, but it was shot on Universal backlot, and Universal also owns all the rights to it. Like they, you know, if you get the DVD to Psycho, it's from Universal, and it's a big part of their backlot tour. So of course, it seems like Norman Bates would be a Universal monster, a psychological monster, but. You know, a human monster, I guess I'm trying to say.
Now, they do have some other questionable entries, and I'd love for us to just kind of riff on this for just a couple of minutes. Darkman.
What?
Liam Neeson is considered a monster by Wikipedia.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, yeah, we do have to mention The Invisible Man, of course, because that's one of the main ones.
That's one that I haven't seen, once again, on my list to watch tonight before Halloween.
Okay, yeah, go for it. It's, It's 1933, funny. And it's the effects they did in 1933 are amazing.
Yeah, I know. So it gets to make an invisible person. I was like, how are you doing this without your green screens in the 30s?
Yeah, it was really complicated. And that was the same year as King Kong. I think 1933 was just a very, very prolific year in effects. But
sure.
The voice, though, Claude Rains has such a good voice in that. And then you have Vincent Price in the sequel, so it's all those Invisible Man movies are pretty good. And then there's even all those spin-offs like Invisible Agent. And Invisible Agent sort of reminds me of Indiana Jones a little bit because it takes place when like Hitler is trying to get a hold of something.
Invisi-Hitler.
What's up?
Invisi-Nazis, Invisi-Hitler.
Exactly. He's trying to use... because it actually takes the idea of what would happen if there really existed invisibility and what if it got into the wrong hands and, you know, World War II is going on and basically, yeah, you nailed it. The Nazis are trying to get a hold of the power of invisibility.
Man. I'm thinking of the comedic aspects for my own sick, twisted humor.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. If I had invisibility abilities, who the hell am I kidding? I'm not going to get off the couch.
It hasn't even been explored as much as it could, which is why I've been waiting for another Invisible Man movie.
Let's make it happen, James.
Yeah.
Well, we did have Hollow Man. We can bring back Kevin Bacon. another... considered a universal monster, and I could kind of see this because it's very kind of has its roots in the 50s, would be Tremors. I could see that. Just because they're that kind of nuclear offspring, like what the hell caused this? I mean, they're in the middle of the desert, or you could say maybe it's more of a Lovecraftian approach with the Chthonians or something like that.
Yeah.
Another later universal monster would be Chucky.
Ah.
Which, not a bad addition, but obviously that's more
that is
modern
a good
horror.
Addition. Why did I not know Chucky was universal?
Yeah, they say Bride of Chucky specifically. Let's see. I want to see who originally did this.
Yeah, because I always counted whoever originally. Because, I mean, they've done Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde before, but the one that's the most classic wasn't universal, which. Yeah. There's several versions of Jekyll and Hyde, actually. I mean, there's ones that go back to where they don't even exist anymore. But then there's like the 20s version with Barrymore. Then you have the 1931. I guess it was late 31 or early 32. I think it was late 31 with Frederick March. That one is the best. Then you have the one with Spencer Tracy in, I'm going to say, 1940 or 41. But then Universal, I think the first time they probably did it was Abbott and Costello meet Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde with Karloff. So it's always a matter of who does it first. And that's actually one thing a lot of people mentioned, that is the T-Rex from Jurassic Park a Universal monster. And I always felt they didn't invent the idea of a killer T-Rex.
No.
You know, go back to Valley of Guanji or
The Lost World.
Lost World, yeah, so it's...
Doesn't King Kong have... I haven't seen the original. Isn't there the T-Rex in that?
Yeah, exactly. So, I always count what they do first. Like, mm-hmm. That's kind of contradicting, too, because it's not like they did the first Dracula or the first Frankenstein, but who made it?
They did the most iconic and well-known.
Yeah.
Now, to update us on the Chucky situation, turns out it was MGM. The reason it's considered a universal monster, because they picked up Bride of Chucky, which I guess the universal monsters would be Chucky and, what's the name of the, Tiffany. And I guess to a lesser extent, the daughter boy thing, Glenn. I don't know. Those movies got stupid after 3.
I've never once seen one of those films because I didn't want to look at my toys in a different light.
I used to think Chucky was coming to kill me when I was a kid. I swear to God, I saw him standing in my doorway when I was like 9 years old.
You saw Chucky?
I swear to God. And here's the thing that made it even more scary. It was during Christmas. So I thought he was going to kill
Chucky
me
on Christmas.
Oh my God. I could see that image in my head and almost hear Brad Dourif's voice. So looking at the Universal movies legacy, now there have been some remakes in the last couple of years. There was a remake
Wolfman.
There was a Wolfman with Benicio del Toro, and
I've not seen that.
I hear it sucks. James, have you seen it?
Yeah, I did a video on that actually when it came out. It was one of those first impression things. I haven't seen it again since, but it's not horrible. It's just
it's not
okay.
Good.
It's just competent, maybe.
It's competent, but I wouldn't say go out of your way to see it.
Another one that was remade in 1979 was Frank Langella and Laurence Olivier's Dracula.
Yeah, now there's a lot of Draculas.
I think he's one of the most used literary characters of all time or something like that.
Uh-huh.
The Mummy and The Mummy Returns are considered remakes. I don't think so.
No, The Mummy technically. If you watch the original Mummy, basically the plot is very similar with Imhotep.
Except with like Brendan Fraser and the guy from Resident Evil.
Pretty much, but the whole story is almost the same. Imhotep is risen, he wants to get the scroll to get the Nooks and a Moon, bring her back, and it's very similar if you watch both of them. That's why I rented the Mummy. Yeah.
Alright.
As a kid. They're very similar, except for their action, and there's no Dwayne the Rock Johnson in the sequel.
See, that's what the original Mummy needed, was the Rock.
Oh, the Scorpion King.
We also have another one. I guess it's not really a remake, but considered in that universe-ish. It was Van Helsing with Hugh Jackman.
Yeah, you know what? I've always been holding out for another really good Monster Mash. And I guess Van Helsing was
Van Helsing.
Oh, what'd you say?
Oh, I just said I enjoyed that film.
Oh, yeah.
It's fun.
That's like the 2000s version of Monster Squad. And Monster Squad was, of course, the new version of the 40s Monster Mash. That's where that all started, really, because, you know, you go back to movies like Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, and it was such a new idea to take two monsters and put them together, because how would it ever work? Like, if you think about it, those monsters would never exist together or at all, really, but they did a really good job finding a way to get them together, even though there are a lot of flaws with those movies.
Mm-hmm.
House of Frankenstein's always been one of my favorites, even though it does such a poor job at getting the monsters together, because they're not even on the screen at the same time. It sort of deals with Dracula, then the rest of the movie's about the Wolfman, and then in the very last minutes it gets into Frankenstein. But the characters that thread it all together are so good. Like Lon Chaney Jr. is so good in that, and Boris Karloff as Dr. Nemon, sort of the monster wrangler. He's really the one that gets it all going. But then they started doing it more often with, you know, movies like Monster Squad, and there actually was an attempt. I've always wanted to see this done. I wanted to see just a newer version of. Hang on one second.
It's all right.
Yeah, let me just get my thoughts together. I've always wanted to see a modern version of the Monster Mash, like seeing.
I think so.
What's up?
No, I was gonna say, I think now would be a great time to do it too. I think with the advent of film we're in, I feel almost with every single big advancement in film, they've been doing these monster mashups, and I feel now is probably a good time again.
Yeah, I've always wanted to see one in the classic style, like seeing one in black and white. And it was attempted, actually. There was a movie called House of the Wolfman,
mm-hmm.
which would have came after House of Frankenstein, House of Dracula. And I really get the sense that the people who made it, like, their hearts were really in it, and they wanted to do, they just, you know, wanted to show their love for those movies. And it was just kind of like a love letter to the fans. But the one thing that went wrong with it, really, was that it's a 75-minute film, which is what they would have been back then. Mm-hmm. The monsters don't show up until the last 15 minutes. And that's the Wolfman. I don't even think Dracula and the Frankenstein monster, they don't even show up until like the last 5 minutes of the movie.
That's terrible. Especially imagine going to see those films and being like, oh, so stoked to see the monsters.
Yeah. Now, when they do show up, they look awesome. The makeup is great, and I love all the thought that went into it. That they have Ron Chaney, by the way, his grandson, as the Wolfman. But the Frankenstein monster is all beat up, and that looks like what would happen to him if he's been through all those other movies. But I think what they should have done was either not market it as a Monster Mash movie, like just let the monsters be a surprise at the end, or mm-hmm. only release it as a short film with the monster part, and have that just be like it would be a big hit at film festivals and monster cons.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you watch the movie and like I'm sitting there and I'm like, where's the monsters?
I know, I came for my Dracula, my Frankenstein monster, like what are you giving me here?
Yeah, and the
5 minutes, thanks.
Yeah, right. But the way they show up, especially Dracula and the Frankenstein monster, they just show up and it's random.
It's really, hey guys, we're in the neighborhood.
Yeah, like it's like literally they just turn around. Dracula's standing in a doorway. It's just like, what? And then it ends
awesome.
Really abruptly. But I do have to say that those few minutes when the monsters are fighting and everything is great. And that. Like you can tell how much better job they did than the actual Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman.
Yeah.
Oh.
Now, let me ask you this, guys. Do you think they could pull this off today and actually have it competent?
I think so.
Like another Monster Mash?
Yeah, like a true... Like, I'm not talking Freddy versus Jason where it's M... Where it's up to you to decide who really won that one. Do you think they could pull off a classic Universal Monster Mash? And would it be a box office success?
I think they can, because right now is a big era of throwbacks. Look at Pacific Rim. You have The Artist. It's a big throwback to an older style of film, to older films people grew up with. And I feel they really could now. That seems to be a very popular thing to do. And I think that they could do it in such a way that you'd get film people and you get a new generation of people who all know about these characters but have nothing really in their mindset and their idea of pop culture. So I think it would be a hit just because of how iconic they are.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where you don't need to build a lot of backstory. Everybody knows these things.
Yeah.
And that's something the Universal movie monsters have done better than anything else, at least from that time period. They are a part of our culture. They literally are cultural icons in the regard that it's... Me and Dave talk about this during our Frankenstein commentary. We mentioned the fact that when we saw a picture of Dracula, even before we knew what it was, we were scared of it. We knew that was Dracula. We didn't even have to know that.
It's the sinister look in his eyes.
Well, it's almost like we're tapping into this universal unconsciousness of fear.
It's our Borg hive mind.
But it's just, I don't know. I find that really cool that this is a legacy that will live on as long as we're around, I think. We're always going to know Frankenstein's monster. We're always going to know Dracula. We're always going to know the Wolfman, Invisible Man, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's just really, really, really neat. So I guess this is my final question to my esteemed panel of guests.
Esteemed? Well, aren't we fancy?
If you could remake any of these movies, which one would it be and why? And I'll go first to give you an idea.
Okay.
Also, think of your dream casting as well. I would like to remake Frankenstein. I would like to cast as my primary Dr. Frankenstein, Michael Fassbender. Because I think he would do the role tremendous justice. There's a package at my door, but I'm going to ignore that. And I think as the monster, I would have it be practical effects. And I want someone who really gives a really good physical performance. And I'd almost give it to one of the former Jasons, actually. And I'll probably get crucified for this one. But I would say Ken Kersinger, who played Jason in Freddy vs. Jason.
Oh my god, why would you pick him? I don't know, I'm just being a troll.
The reason I would pick him, physicality and how you get more out of him. Kane Hodder played a wonderful Jason, but it's more brutality. Mm-hmm. With I feel with Ken Kersinger, you get a little bit more emotion with the brutality. So I think if you gave him a Frankenstein role where he's more the innocence of a child, but he has the brute strength of, well, a brute, I think it might be remarkably interesting. My dream director for this might be Darren Aronofsky for this one. So let's go to you, Scotty.
Oh, my God. Please don't go to me. I'm still trying to think. I haven't.
All right there, James, what about you?
Oh, I guess if I had to pick one because I'm going with the Monster Mash theme, I would pick House of Frankenstein. And I think the first thing I would do is get more monsters in it and have them all interact a little bit more with each other, too. Because you have Dr. Niemann, who is basically double-crossing everybody in the movie, and he's giving all these promises to all these monsters, like Dracula, I'll always make sure that I have your coffin ready, and you know, you always have fresh blood and everything, but then he uses Dracula for as long as he needs him and then gets rid of him. I always felt he would be doing the same thing with the mummy and just like pull off his bandages at the most inconvenient time. I think there'd be a lot of comedic potential in it. As far as casting, I haven't really thought about it yet. There's just a lot of characters to cast. So
just find a way to put Chris Rock in there. I don't know why.
Chris Rock, let's see. He could be
Blackula.
Blackula. All right.
Actually, James, you would know the answer to this question more so than anybody I could possibly ask. Now, there was Blackula, which was a blaxploitation film.
Yeah.
Was there ever a like, Blackenstein
or yes, anything? Yes, there was.
Holy yeah. shit.
There was, if I'm correct, there was also Dr. Black and Mr. Hyde.
By God.
I mean, they made every kind of movie they could in the 70s. It was just, you know.
The Blackie is the Black Mummy.
How would you do a Black Invisible Man?
Now, that's interesting. I don't know. I mean, could be done. I'm actually surprised it hasn't.
Okay, here's your YouTube challenge. Make us a non-racially offensive.
Oh, well, then you can't do it.
Oh my God, that's so racist.
Just kidding.
Moving on. The Black Invisible Man. If you can make this happen, let us know.
But the thing is, those movies kind of will pull on those, like, stereotypes.
I mean, he wouldn't really be black, technically, if he's invisible, because if you're invisible, you're whiter than white. You're just...
Yeah.
You're clear.
So he'd be a black man with a white man problem.
I don't know.
We are going to hell for this conversation.
I'm already in hell.
All right, Scotty, what about you? What's the monster movie you would remake Dreamcasting?
Oh, my gosh. I'm not good at this. I know I want to do a Dracula because I love that character so much, but it's been done so many times. But
I thought there's new ways you can do it, I think.
Yeah, there are for sure. I like the plot they had, like the story in the original. Like, I'm just trying to think of who I'd have as a Dracula who can kind of captivate somebody with a mesmerizing feel when you see them on film.
Yeah.
See, that's the hardest part because right when you said a remake, that was always what hit in my head. But just trying to find someone who could do it now. Almost a similar light to Bela Lugosi.
Well, you know, but Christopher Lee's still alive. Get him back.
Yeah, we saw him in The Hobbit. He had to sit down for all his acting roles.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Holy shit. Sorry to break the mood here. I just got this awesome package from Ubisoft.
Right okay.
I have this giant Assassin's Creed press kit. Where the hell am I going to put this?
My hands.
My wife just... what the hell? Okay, awesome. Now she's handing me food. Anyway, moving on. Sorry, guys. That was very distracting.
I almost think Hugo Weaving could pull off a Dracula.
I could see that.
Instead of Dracula, it should just be the Castlevania movie.
That'd be awesome, actually.
As Dracula. But have it be like kind of like the beginning of Symphony of the Night or something.
Exactly, with Alucard, and he's coming like, oh, I'll defeat you.
Yeah, and he gets killed like in the beginning. So
Christopher Lee Dracula is the first boss.
Yeah, Christopher Lee, there's no better way. And then, so he kills Dracula, and then the title screen comes up and says, Castle fucking Vania. The rest of the movie.
Amazing.
I think then the rest of it would be all about putting Dracula back together, like in Castlevania 2. So it would be Christopher Lee as like a ghost, and it would just be his voice, because then all you need him for is just to like digitize his face, and then that would be a way to get him in the rest of the movie. Because obviously you're not going to get Christopher Lee to perform as Dracula.
Hugo Weaving in there. It's Alucard.
Oh, boy. Actually, supposedly they are still making the Castlevania movie. Last I heard,
mm-hmm.
I don't think Uwe Boll was attached, so thank Christ for that. I want to say it was Len Wiseman, but I'm not even sure about that. And he was the guy who did Die Hard. He's the guy who did Live Free or Die Hard. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure about that one. So consider that one up in the air. So, guys, we pretty much reached the end of this conversation. We had a lot of really good talks on this, and I'm really happy to see that these movies can still be appreciated today.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not necessarily – they don't have, like, the best special effects. They don't even have the best acting in them sometimes. But the fact that these films can suck you in with atmosphere, with certain performances, and even the questions that they raise, you know – philosophically, I think that's really, really, really cool, and I'm glad these movies are going to be with us pretty much the rest of civilization anyway.
Yeah.
So, I guess, James, this will be final question to you. If you could recommend three of these movies people must see before next week's Halloween, which three are they?
I want to pick one of the Wolfmans, but you know what? Like if I were to just pick three, I think a great trilogy to watch is Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, and Son of Frankenstein. Have you guys got to Son of Frankenstein yet?
Not yet.
Yeah, when you get to that one, it's my favorite that grew on me over the years, but don't go into it expecting much of the monster. It really isn't the monster's movie. It's more about the actual Son of Frankenstein played by...
I was hoping there'd be a scene where Frankenstein and Son of Frankenstein were playing baseball in the front yard. Yeah. And like mom would be like, pie's ready. It'd be like the Munsters.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's another thing is that Colin Clive is in it. So when you get to the third one, you're like, okay, well, there's no more Mary Shelley material. You don't have Colin Clive. Karloff is in there again, but he's mute again. But Lugosi steals the whole movie as Igor. And it's longer than the other movies, too. It feels like a much more fuller, sophisticated movie. It's basically just a battle of wits between the Son of Frankenstein and Igor.
I'm going to have to check this out before Halloween.
For sure. Yeah.
So those are my three picks.
All right, then. I think for me, if I were to recommend three, I would definitely recommend, obviously, Dracula and Frankenstein. And I would say The Wolfman. So the three ones that I've seen and enjoyed the most so far. Scotty, what about yourself?
The ones, I think, to get somebody into this, someone who's a fan of, say, I guess isn't really a cinephile, they say, I'd probably throw Creature of the Black Lagoon, just because it still has a lot of similarities to more modern cinema, not in regards of Dracula, which would be my second choice, would be Dracula, because coming off of the talkie, right into the talkies, it's so awesome to see this, that it's only 4 years into this whole new thing of film, and just the way you see great acting from Bela Lugosi just doing the show in that. And then I'd say The Mummy, just because of its modern counterpart, which is the whole reason I watched the original. And they share a lot of similarities. So you wouldn't be so lost seeing that one either.
All right.
Can't go wrong. You know what I do have to mention, though? Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. Just because I just got to give like an honorable mention, just because that was the first one that I saw. And It opens with the best cemetery scene ever and ends with one of the greatest monster fights ever. So you just have, I think that's a really entertaining one that could hook somebody in, because it hooked me in.
My honorable mention might be Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Yeah.
So I guess, James, since this is going to be airing today, October the 24th, what's coming up on Cinemasker over the next week and leading up to Halloween?
Oh, well, we have one more horror series to get to. And that's coming
Weekend at Bernie's.
Weekend at Bernie's.
Like I said last year, I was hoping for some Weekend at Bernie's, but there's only one sequel.
Especially when he's a zombie in the second one. Well, you know what? You're not too far off then.
Ooh, exciting stuff. Also coming up on the show for This Week in Geek, we have a couple of DVD commentaries coming up. I know people are going to give us hate mail for Dracula and Frankenstein, because it was Dave's first time, my second time, so I know we get a few things wrong, but you're coming more for the conversation there. Same with Frankenstein. And then we watched The Conjuring, the latest release from James Wan, of the guy who did Insidious. That's coming out on Halloween. Plus, you can find, I think we should have the conclusion of our role-playing Call of Cthulhu podcast over on thesewarriorsareterrible.com. Where I play a veteran World War I soldier who has a itchy trigger finger and is immensely fucked up. And also more episodes of the Untitled Mike and Laura Project, Last Exit to Ponyville, because season 4 is coming up. And for the topic show for the month of November, we're going to go back through 50 years of space and time. We're looking at Doctor Who, the entirety of the franchise, leading up to, we'll probably release the episode on the Day of the Doctor, so save the date. Ooh. November 23rd for that. I'm looking forward to it.
Nice.
So guys, for This Week in Geek and Cinemasker.com, we have been, that's your cue,
which one of us? I'll go first.
Okay,
it was me, Scott.
Bordash, yeah. The me, not yeah. The...
Oh. okay.
That's James. All right, guys, and I've been Mike the Birdman Dodd saying, the creatures of the night, what beautiful music they make.
Wanna see me make bubbles with my spit?
Sure do. In fact, that's the theme of our next show. So don't miss it.
What the hell happened to George Lucas?
Oh my God, there's snot on my face. And I'm your host, Mike the Birdman Dub. And I'm not a join. Not a join. What the f*** does that mean? That 10 seconds.
No, you gotta keep that.
Let's do this. Let's do this right the first time.
F*** you guys. Ew, it's in my mouth. Oh, God.
Oh, what's it taste like, Mike?
Water. Ew, salty.
Let's start this episode with shat.
okay, I'm good. Geico. Holy shit. Oh, my gosh. Freak. Die. Holy crap. Whoa. Whoa, my God, whoa. Where did it go?
I'm like a stupid monkey.
As you can imagine, they don't let us out much.
You've been listening to This Week in Geek. Tune in next week to hear, somebody random. I don't know. Maybe even a hot chick. Yeah, let's go with that.
Did anyone ever tell you that you were very, very sexy?
How are you? Actually, no.
They never will.
Check out our website, thisweekingeek.net, for more geek content, as well subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or any podcatcher. If you'd like to comment on this episode, head to this episode post on thisweekingeek.net and comment through Facebook Connect. Or you can call our voicemail line at 817-717-7202. Send us a Twitter message by replying to @ThisWeekInGeek. Lastly, you can email us at feedback@thisweekingeek.net. This extra music was produced by Pronobozo at PronoBozo.com. We'll see you next time, and remember...
Lower your shields and surrender your listenership.